Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today will be familiar to many of our Texas listeners, both because he's a Texas legend and also because he's been on our podcast before. It is Dr. Bill Criss, who is of counsel to the SNAPCA Law Firm, the head of the State Bar Appellate Section right now, and about a dozen other things. But interestingly, I learned not a Rhodes Scholar. That came up
recently. That's right. That came up the other day. One of my favorite things about all the speeches I give is getting to listen to people introduce me. And they often get something wrong. And it's because they're trying to be nice. And so they assume that my accolades are like as big as they can imagine. And they're not. So like my bio says that I was nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship by the University of Texas when I was 20. And that's true. But I didn't get it.
Well, it's an honor just to be nominated. I mean, come on.
That's what I thought. I guess maybe I wasn't a good enough athlete or something.
Well, Bill, I think, Todd, you can correct me. I think you are our guest for our 150th episode. Is that right?
That is 100% correct. Yeah. We've had to pivot a little bit. We were originally going to do some listener questions and just have it be just me and Jody for our 150th episode. And that idea completely tanked. I don't know if it's an indication of the status of our listenership or just the poor state of social media these days, but we didn't receive any questions. So, Bill, I don't mean to make you sound like a consolation prize because you're certainly not that. We have you here to talk about a very, very important topic today. So I think it's very fitting that this topic be addressed in our 150th episode. So thanks for being here with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And 150th, is that sesquicentennial or something? The things that I like to talk about these days all have to do with American history and oftentimes legal history, and more specifically, constitutional history. You guys know I wrote a book about Texas constitutional history. I basically write largely about Texas history because the source material is easily accessible to me. But our local bar association asked me to be the keynote speaker on Law Day this year. And the actual topic for Law Day throughout the country this year was the Constitution, one out of many. And that made me think immediately about the Federalist Papers and James Madison's Federalist Number 10. And that led me in other directions. And just, you know, I'm sure your viewers already know this, but I mean, just to recap, Madison's Federalist Number 10 is really relevant to this year's Law Day subject because it deals with the evils of faction and the ways in which our republic was designed to remedy or ameliorate the effects of faction. And there are a number of different ways in which the architects of our system did that. One is separation of powers. Another is a subset of separation of powers, which is an independent judiciary. Another is Madison believed, and Hamilton agreed with him, that the mere geographical extent of the country was such that it would prevent factions from coming together to be powerful enough to be able to create oppression for the rest of us. Madison also thought that rather than having a direct democracy as they had in ancient Athens and other Greek and Roman city-states, that another check against the evils of faction was the fact that rather than people voting directly on every piece of legislation because the country was too big, electing representatives to do that. And Madison's belief was that those elected representatives would serve as a filter that would filter out the passions and prejudices of their constituents. Some of those, and there are more, there's the Bill of Rights, of course, which Hamilton talks about in Federalist 78 as being, along with an independent judiciary to enforce them, the primary safeguards against oppression by the government. And there are more. There are more safety switches built into the system. So the two reasons why I thought this subject would be of interest is, first of all, because it was directly addressed by Law Day this year. And secondly, because I think as somebody who used to be involved in the ethics practice, the legal ethics practice, I think we sometimes overlook the duties that we as lawyers have to the system in general. In other words, the duties that go beyond our mere duties to our clients. And, you know, the preamble to the Texas Lawyers Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct contains a whole bunch of aspirational standards, including that it's a lawyer's duty to generate respect and demonstrate respect for the legal system, to uphold the rule of law. As a public citizen, the lawyer should seek improvement of the law and in the administration of the law. And a lawyer should be keeping up with her education and using that education in the law, and which includes, of course, the Constitution, for the benefit not just of your clients, but also for the benefit of society more broadly. And so for all those reasons, this is a topic that piqued my interest, together with the fact that one of the phrases that I hear most constantly or most consistently, most often these days, whether on social media or in person, is people will say, boy, we live in crazy times. And so one of my Law Day messages as a historian is the United States of America has lived through crazier times. Our society has in the past been more divided, more afflicted with what the founders called the evils of faction and hyperpartisanship. In the 1820s and 1830s, we were divided over the allegation that an election had been stolen in 1824, when John Quincy Adams was elected president by the House of Representatives and immediately appointed Henry Clay as his Secretary of State, when it was Clay who, finishing fourth in the Electoral College ballot, threw his support to Adams in the House of Representatives and got him elected president, the so-called, what was later called the corrupt bargain to keep Andrew Jackson out of the presidency. And that resulted in a massive pendulum swing the other direction 4 years later, where Jackson was elected and took out his vengeance on the National Bank and anybody else that he thought were representative of the commercial interests in the Northeast that had defeated him.
I can't imagine any present analog to anything like that.
Oh, you know, I mean, one of the things that really struck me about this topic, and I guess the primary conclusion that I came away from, is how incredibly brilliant these people were, these men were, the founders of our republic. Their foresight is incredible. And I'll give you an example that I marked just because it freaked me out so badly when I came across it. Because I started with the Federalist Papers, you know, Federalist number 10 and Federalist number 78. But then I started thinking, well, where else could I find the, you know, founders' thought about faction and, you know, the ways in which it might cause problems for a representative democracy or a republic such as us. And I came upon George Washington's farewell address from 1796, 3 years before he died, when he finally was sort of allowed by the country to go back to his plantation. And what he did was, you know, he was so old and so decrepit by that point, and, you know, we all know the stories about his wooden teeth and stuff, he didn't want to give a speech. And so he wrote a letter to the American people and circulated it to a friendly newspaper and had, I forget which one, and had that newspaper publish it. And then it was republished over and over again many times. Washington's farewell address is often cited for is his warning about foreign entanglements. And it was used for many decades as a justification for American isolationism, which, of course, carried the day until at least the early 20th century. But Washington warned about some other stuff. And the two biggest things he warned about were, number one, foreign entanglements, but number two, the evils of faction. And what Washington had to say about the evils of faction was incredibly prescient because, you know, Washington's not really thought of as being an intellectual giant among the founders. And there's actually some thought among historians that Madison may have ghostwritten much of Washington's farewell address, because Madison clearly was a brilliant man. And this is what Washington said about faction, which by which the founders were always referring to hyperpartisanship, partisanship in general. Washington said this. He said, invariably at length leads to a more formal and permanent despotism. The disorders and miseries which result from faction gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition of the people to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. It serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, and kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection. It opens the door to foreign influence and corruption, which find a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passions. And thus, the policy and the will of one country are subjected to the policy and will of another. And, you know, reading that, I thought, man, did these guys have a crystal ball or what? And the other thing Washington says, I didn't have an excerpt to quote today, but, you know, you can trust me on this way. Washington mentions that revenge is a natural aspect of partisanship. And he goes on to talk about how the way that faction generates this despotism, tyranny of the individual who people flock to as the man on the white horse who will save them and obliterate the opponent, whoever that opponent might be. What Washington says is that the longer the pendulum swings between factions, the more extreme the swings get, such that eventually what happens is the desire for revenge and the animosity between the parties becomes so extreme that at long last, what happens is one of them will essentially obliterate the other. And that's how you end up with despotism or tyranny. You know, after you think about that, then the question becomes, well, okay, my goodness. So Madison's telling us how to control the evils of faction. Washington's telling us exactly what's going to happen if faction goes unchecked. And so how does that apply to the lawyer's ethical role in modern, you know, in current society, postmodern, not modern, but postmodern society? And that requires a lot of thinking. You know, that requires a lot of thinking. It's like, what are the substitutes in the current day for the things that Madison thought would control the evils of faction? Because the mere geographical extent of the United States is no longer much of a guarantee. Because in Madison's time, obviously, if you wanted to communicate with a bunch of other people and organize them into a party or a faction, that was a very difficult thing to do on a grand scale. You'd have to get in a Conestoga wagon or something, or ride a horse with a message. You know, you'd have to have 100 Paul Revere's. But now, you know, we can do it in an instant over the internet. And you see it on social media.
Oh, absolutely.
So that one won't work very much. The other one, the filtering by elected representatives has become problematic. And the reason it's become problematic is because of what constitutional lawyers refer to as partisan gerrymandering. We know that racial gerrymandering historically was a violation of the Voting Rights Act and also probably violated the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. But we know that the United States Supreme Court recently, in recent years, has turned down writs of certiorari in at least one case that I'm familiar with, where the allegation was that partisan gerrymandering actually violated the Equal Protection Clause's sort of general criteria, you know, of one man, one vote, or one person, one vote. The good news is the Supreme Court didn't decide the issue. The bad news is the Supreme Court refused to decide the issue, which in a way is a decision, right? So I think one of the things that lawyers should think about, and that political scientists, believe me, do think about, and historians do think about regularly, is what can we do about partisan gerrymandering? And what I mean by partisan gerrymandering is this. Any political scientist will tell you, and actually anybody who just watches the news will tell you, that every 2 years, less than 10% of the seats in Congress are actually competitive or in jeopardy between the two major parties. There are 438 members of Congress, members of the House of Representatives, and what? Maybe in a massive, you know, watershed election, 40 of those would change hands between the Republicans and the Democrats. So it's less than 10%. And this is replicated in state legislatures all over the country, where if you go to, for example, North Carolina, where one of these cases came out of, in North Carolina, it's a purple state. It's roughly 51% Republican, 52% Republican, 48, 49% Democrat. But those percentages are in no way reflected in either house of the state legislature. You can just go state by state, and it's not universally true, but it's almost universally true that this problem of gerrymandering is replicated from state to state. That's a problem, right? Because, and the reason it's a problem is because whether you're a state legislator or you're a congressperson, the founders knew that the way to protect liberty was to pit the self-interest of these office holders against each other, which is why we have separation of powers, because each branch would presumably be jealous of its own authority. The problem with partisan gerrymandering is it creates a situation where almost no public official is worried about the other party. They're always worried about being primaried within their own party by someone more extreme than them. And what this does is it has the effect of accelerating the distance through which the pendulum swings between the two parties, which is precisely what Washington and Madison warned us against, is both parties are becoming increasingly extreme. I came upon a research center study that basically demonstrated through polling what we all kind of know instinctively. And that's this, that over the last 20 years, the number of Republicans who see Democrats in an extremely negative way has gone up by a factor of two or three. 20 years ago, yeah, most Republicans had negative views of Democrats, but only about 16 or 17% of Republicans thought that they were extremely bad. And almost the exact same percentages for Democrats in their views of Republicans. There was an analysis done of the policy positions of people who are self-identified as Republicans or Democrats. And what they found was more than 90% of Republicans surveyed were to the right of the median Democrat on the issues. And more than 90% of Democrats were to the left of median Republicans on the issues. And the reason this is concerning is because this is increasingly getting to be a long time, but when I was a boy, the main complaint about the two major political parties is that they were too much alike. And now the main complaint is that they're too different. When I was a boy, we, in my family, my father was, like me, an independent voter. In those days, he would say, well, you know, we vote for the man and not the party. And of course, there weren't very many women running then, so we're talking about the early 60s. But in my family, you know, if somebody was going to land on the moon, you had to watch it. If the president got shot, you had to watch the funeral and all that stuff. You had to watch Walter Cronkite on the news. And you had to watch both of the national political conventions. And as a kid watching this stuff, you know, I would ask my dad, well, you know, who's this guy? Who's that guy? And my dad would say, well, okay, that guy's the lead liberal Republican. That guy is the lead conservative Republican. And that guy's in between. And he would say, you know, we'd watch the Democratic Party convention. And he'd say, well, that guy's a conservative Democrat. That guy's a liberal Democrat. That guy's in between. You don't have that anymore. It doesn't exist, right? The parties are ideologically uniform. And so what's happened is we have created a situation that has not improved. It's gotten worse as a result of hyperpartisanship. And so one of the things that lawyers can do, because we have a duty to use our educations in reform of the law, is to do whatever we can to try to solve the problem of redistricting, which is just the worst form of political sausage making. The other thing that we can do is whatever we can to atomize the factions that exist, right? So Madison tells us that the more factions we have, the better off we are, because it becomes increasingly difficult as you multiply the number of factions, it becomes increasingly difficult for factions to coalesce around this or that issue and create oppression for everybody else. And so the more factions we have, the better off we are. Now, another Pew Research study indicated that 49% of voters between the ages of 18 and 35 believe that we need more political parties, that the two political parties that we do have are insufficient or they have a negative view of those parties. That same research study showed that 25% of Americans self-identify as independents, which I think is a good thing, but that when you look at their actual stands on the issues, a majority of Americans, adult Americans, a majority of Americans actually have very eclectic views and roughly equal number of conservative and liberal positions if you ask them about the actual issues. And that, again, is a good thing. What lawyers can do about this is manyfold. First of all, it's our job as members of the third branch of government to do what judges can't do, which is to protect the judiciary. So when someone attacks a judge for an unpopular decision that's well-reasoned, or someone wants to, you know, threaten a judge's family or whatever, it's lawyers who have to speak out in defense of the judiciary. And the other thing we can do to create a larger number of factions and to decrease the amount of false charisma, which is to say, you know, charisma that's generated by lying or by misinformation, is I think it's important for public-minded citizens to each develop a particular area of expertise. In other words, become an expert on something. I am a bad example of that because I'm basically kind of a dilettante who's become a Renaissance man. You know, hopefully at some point when I'm old enough, I'll reach Renaissance man. But everybody
Bill,
else,
you're there. You're there already.
I think everybody else, I think everybody else can develop an expertise. Because what drives me crazy is when I'm on social media and I see these so-called influencers of the right and of the left, who they talk a million miles an hour. They basically just try to cow their questioners into submission by machine gun type delivery, what we used to call the spread in scholastic debate, where you just say as much stuff as possible and hope that there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't get rebutted, right? And the only real solution to that is if you're an expert in something and one of these guys, one of these machine gun guys comes out and starts talking a bunch of malarkey, nobody knows whether that's true or not unless you're an expert. And you can say, no, wait a minute. That's not what Acts chapter 4 says in the Bible. If you happen to be an expert on ancient Christian history or something, that can really help. The other thing that can really help, I think, is this. It is clear to me, at least, that the founders had clearly in mind separation of church and state. They were very concerned about the extent to which religious division produced political factions. And they had good reason to be concerned. They, within their living memory, was the Glorious Revolution of 1688 that produced the political thought of John Locke, who is one of the architects of the whole representative democracy project. And that was the end that was put to the English Civil War, which was bloody and horrible. And so, for example, people will point to, well, you know, when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, we say it's under God. Or people will point to, well, the oath of office says, you know, you swear, so help you God. That's all true. But the reason it's true is, and Washington says this explicitly in his farewell address, the reason that's true is because the founders believed in civic virtue. They believed that you had to have civic virtue for a republic to work. And they also believed that what Washington says explicitly in his farewell address is, it's hard for me to imagine a situation where someone can have civic virtue or civic morality and not believe in some form of divinity. That's literally what he says. I'm paraphrasing it, but it's very close to exactly what he says. So people will point to this and say, well, the founders were Christians, or the founders believed in, you know, they were fine with God being here or there or whatever. What the founders believed was that you needed to, and the state constitutions, the revolutionary state constitutions, if you look at them, many of them have provisions in them that say, they have provisions that say two things, which is kind of an interesting thing. The first one is that in order to hold public office, you need to profess belief in a supreme being. So those laws are there, but they're usually combined with laws that say there can be no religious test for holding public office, which is what we have in the Constitution, Article 6. The United States Constitution, Article 6. And so what that means is that the founders definitely believed in a separation of church and state to the point where the only involvement of the state with religion was to ensure that the oaths that public officials take are enforceable, because they actually believed that something bad would happen to them in some eternal way if they violated the oath. We've come a ways since then, and most people today, unlike Washington, can imagine a situation where people would have a public morality or a civic morality without necessarily belief in a supreme being. But my point is, we as lawyers know this. We know this kind of stuff. And it's our job to tell people about it. And there's more. I've been asking myself, and Jody was there when I asked this rhetorical question, do we really want Republican judges and Democratic judges? Do we really want to live in a world where every time a federal judge makes a ruling, the first thing that the news services say is which president appointed her? It would be nice if we could ameliorate or reduce the amount of partisanship that continues to seep into the judicial branch of government, which is supposed to be independent of that.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today.
And I also think, and you guys can correct me because you would know more about this than I would. You follow the Texas Supreme Court more closely than I do, but it's my recollection that within the last 50 years, all of the former chief justices of the Texas Supreme Court have expressed some form of reservation about the way in which we go about selecting our judges in state courts in Texas.
That's certainly true in the last 25
years,
I know.
At least within the last 25 years.
100% agree. I mean, in my entire experience as a lawyer, that's been true.
And we as lawyers, because we have an obligation to improve the law, and obviously that's in the eye of the beholder, but just as there are structural impediments, some of the things that we've already been talking about, such as, you know, the way in which we go about redistricting. Another structural impediment, and this is, I don't know, people say that I'm creating an issue where there isn't one or that this is not a big deal, but I kind of think it is. If you think about it, we have laws in the election code, and most states do, probably all states do, have laws in the election code and the government code that privilege being a Democrat or a Republican. I've had conversations with people who are politicians and who have thought to run for this office or that, and especially if they're thinking about running for an office in the judicial branch, I always ask them this question, which is, why don't you run as an independent? Why don't you just run as an independent? And they go, well, why would I want to do that? And I say, well, first reason you'd want to do that is because your campaign platform is built in. All you have to do is say, I'm running for judge as an independent. That's all you need to say. And people will instinctively understand what that means. And the reason they instinctively understand what that means is because if you and I go to a football game between the Cowboys and the Eagles, and the referee is wearing a Cowboys uniform, you're going to start worrying a little bit about whether or not that referee is totally neutral, right? And so that's one thing that we could do right away is just lawyers in general, sort of unorganized members of the bar, could just create a sort of Weltanschauung, a sort of mindset where we go, why aren't you guys running as independents? And of course, the answer I always get is, I can't win. And then I say, well, why can't you win? Well, I'd have to get 500. Well, here's the deal. You have to get five, at least if it's a local election, you have to get 500 petition signatures. And you have to get them in a very short window of time. And you have, and only people who did not vote in either party's primary can sign the petition, or you can't get on the ballot. That's number one. Number two is, even if you get on the ballot, it's very hard for people to find you. Because by law, there's a column on the far left that people are used to looking for, that's always the column of the candidates of the party of the governor who won the last gubernatorial election. And by law, the next column is the other party, the other major party. And then, I need to look this up because I don't know the answer to this. I don't know how they figure out where to put the Libertarians and the Greens and the American Party and the Constitution Party. I don't know where they put all those people, but I do know that the independent candidate goes all the way at the end, all the way at the far right. So there are structural impediments. As a political scientist, I'm going to tell you, I think ballot position makes a difference. I've seen election where I thought that the first candidate on the ballot, you know, let's say it's a local election and they just candidate number one, candidate number two. I think candidate number one has an edge, certainly has an edge over candidate number nine. We had an election here locally where the ballot for one office was 2 pages long, electronic pages long. And there were two guys at the end who were on the second page. There were disclaimers like, hey, you know, push this arrow, there's more, you know, but it's still, you don't want to be those two guys. You know, if you have a choice, you don't want to be those two guys. So those are my ruminations about this subject. The thing that I think people like hearing more than anything else is they like hearing from a historian that things have been worse, and things have been worse.
That caught my attention when you said it. Things have been worse probably, and if not our lifetimes, then not too long before that.
I don't think they've been worse in our lifetime, but they have been worse before that.
I guess that makes me feel a little better. I don't know. I guess the point is in that this too shall pass maybe is kind of the lesson, as long as we can learn what we need to learn and preserve the rule of law.
Yeah. The bad news is if we don't do something about it, the foreboding of the forefathers, the founders, is that it won't get better. Because for the reason that I quoted Washington on, which is if the pendulum keeps swinging further and further between right and left, and this is the analogy that I used yesterday at Law Day, was think about The Tale of Two Cities, the famous Dickens book that in the old days we read in junior high school or high school. Madame Defarge is always knitting. She's knitting. And what's she knitting? She's knitting in the names of the nobility who are going to be destroyed if there's ever a revolution and Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI are ever overthrown. And so you don't want to be in a position where you have to choose between Louis XVI and Robespierre, right? That's a bad choice. A guy came up to me when I gave this talk a few days ago, and I actually loved this. It was so great. And said, highly educated guy, obviously, and said, I just think it's impractical what you're talking about. He said, you know, independent candidates is too hard. And, you know, the other team that's the opposite team for me, it would be nice if we could have this, everybody play nice and all reason together. But, you know, when they come after me, I have to come after them. He says, you're one of those guys in 1917, if you'd been in Russia, you know, you would have been one of those guys trying to stop the communist revolution, but not supporting the czar. And communists would have taken over and put you in a gulag. And I said, thank you. That is exactly where I would have been. I would have been the guy with Alexander Kerensky and the other moderates who said, yeah, the czar is bad and we need to get rid of him. And a democratic republic is what we want. And I will do everything I can to stop the communists. And that's exactly what I would have been doing. And as I say, I think that people like me don't want to speak for anybody else, but people like me are the ballast of the Republic. Sometimes we need Keynesian economics. Sometimes we need Milton Friedman's economics. Sometimes we need insularity from foreign affairs. Sometimes we need to be interventionist. Depends on those nasty little things we call facts. And so, you know, I'm pro-logic. I'm pro-grammar. I think that postmodernism and deconstructionism are a bunch of baloney. I would defend anyone's right to learn them or teach them. I think they're neo-Marxist baloney. I believe in logic and grammar. And I would argue with my liberal arts professors about this. And I would have people tell me, I would have professors tell me, I would say, well, what about math? Surely you don't object to math. No, math actually, if you think about it, is actually a tool of oppression. It's part of binaries of subjugation. And it's a tool of the patriarchy. I'm like, dude, we're talking about base 10 here. There's nothing. It's arbitrary in the extreme. It's made up, but it's the way the world works. You cannot put a man on the moon without it. And I would argue the same thing about grammar. If you deconstruct grammar and you say, well, you know, language is all fungible and meanings are all arbitrary, which is what the deconstructionists love, these guys, Derrida and all these guys, Levi Strauss. It's baloney. If you take that to the logical extreme, communication becomes impossible because grammar is a form of logic, just as mathematics is a form of logic. And you know who knows that better than anyone is appellate lawyers, because we're trained in that kind of logical argumentation and in identifying logical fallacies. And oh my God, the world is full of logical fallacies. All you got to do is turn on your computer and oh, here comes ad hominem. I don't know what the Latin root, I don't know what the Latin, you guys might know. I don't know what the Latin phrase for it is. I need to learn it. It's the whataboutism fallacy, you know, where you go, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the guy who's you're talking to goes, well, what about this? You know, it's like, well, no, I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about what I just said. Yeah. But, you know, the world is full of this kind of illogical argumentation. And the people who are contributing to it the most are on the far left, neo-Marxist deconstructionist people who think that and I would ask them, I say, well, if there's no meaning, where do you find meaning? And they say, well, binaries of subjugation. You figure out who's oppressing who and be for the little guy. I'm like, well, right now I kind of feel like the little guy. So you're subjugating me right now. Well, that's different because I'm reversing the polarity. And you're like, man, you're just making this stuff up. It's not logical. So that's the hill I die on is logic. That is the hill I die on.
Which is why you do appellate law and not as much trial work. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, you're kidding. You're kidding.
Speaking of whataboutism.
Oh, my God.
Touche.
The biggest judgment I ever got in a trial court on my own, it was a multi-million-dollar judgment. And it was a bad faith case. And I destroyed them. I was suing an insurance company, and I had internal witnesses, internal stuff, where they had secret meetings. I mean, it was all the really good bloody shirt stuff, right? I mean, it's like just tearing them up. What ended up being a friendly four-person presiding juror who had had a bad experience with an insurance company that was somewhat similar, and all of which was revealed during voir dire. I'm thinking, man, I'm just killing these guys. And the jury comes back with a 10-2 verdict in my favor. And I'm like, who are these two people? It was two little old ladies on the jury. And I never talked to juries back when I tried cases. I never talked to them because, I don't know, I just felt bad. I just didn't want to do it. Just I felt uncomfortable doing it. So I would get my paralegal or somebody else to talk to the jurors. So I had them talk to the presiding juror and say, hey, you know, Mr. Chris wants to know, like, what happened? I mean, why could the rest of you not convince the two holdouts? And this is what my legal assistant was told. He says, yeah. So, you know, we had a rough time with that. Said, they were driving me crazy. He says, but they just kept saying that no matter what the evidence showed, Mr. Chris was beating up that other lawyer so bad that we were afraid. He was a younger guy, obviously not as experienced as Mr. Chris. And, you know, we kept noticing how scuffed up his boots were. And we thought to ourselves, you know, if we give these people everything they're entitled to, that poor guy's going to lose his job. And I thought, what a perfect commentary on why juries are a black box. Now, I personally think juries should be a black box because that's what, that's what gets cases resolved, gets cases settled. But I mean, I could tell you at least three or four more stories like that. The biggest case I ever argued, I lost. I think I argued for $100 million, and this is a multiple death case. And we lost the case. Part of the case we tried, we lost. We'd settled a bunch of the rest of it, which is one reason we lost. But that was another situation where I actually talked to the guy. I asked the presiding juror. I said, man, I mean, did I do a bad job or what happened? He goes, that thing that happened right before final argument, that really worked against you. And I realized what he was talking about. Right before final argument, when the judge was reading the charge to the jury, there was a little lady sitting next to the foreman. He was a big guy, big foreman. And she started coughing paroxysmally, just coughing and coughing. She would not stop coughing. She was obviously having a problem. And nobody did anything to help her. And I was the lawyer who was sitting closest to her. The judge was deaf or something. He didn't realize what was going on. And so finally, like, I got up and go, judge, I think the juror needs some help or something like that. And the judge, oh, okay. You know, the bailiff went and got her a cup of water. The foreman of the jury told me that if I had gotten up and gone and gotten her a drink of water, the case would have gone better for me, even though that would have been a violation of the court's instructions, where all you're supposed to do in your interaction with the jury is tell them politely good morning or good evening. And so, yeah, people ask me, well, why did you decide to become exclusively an appellate lawyer? You know, there are two reasons. The first reason is I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. The second reason is something that Reagan Simpson told me that I always repeat to people. Reagan's such a brilliant guy. Reagan said, you know, Bill, the great thing about being an appellate lawyer is you really don't have to sweat it all that much because we're just like golf caddies. We carry around the bag. It has clubs in it. The judges pick which clubs they want to use, and they, most of the time, they will not listen to you. You tell them they need a number one driver, and they will pick the putter. You know, whatever happens is not your fault. They're just going to do what they're going to do. In a way, that's kind of like what juries do, but in a different way. That always made me feel better. You know, it's like, I'm going to make the best argument I can. I'm going to write the best brief that I can, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do. And it has almost nothing to do with me.
Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step, From review to filing, Council Press has your back. Visit councilpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal.
That's a good reminder. And I think I heard Reagan tell that story at some point in my career early on. And your Reagan Simpson impression at the very beginning was actually pretty good.
Oh, man. Oh, I actually can do Reagan, but I have too much admiration for him to do it. But, I mean, there's a lot of appellate lawyers I can do impressions of. I will not give you the list.
We're going to have you on like an appellate podcast after dark excerpt for Patreon subscribers.
When we're not on the air, I can do a few for you. But my problem is I'm getting to be to the point where the people... I used to actually be a stand-up comic. I used to do impressions for free drinks and stuff when I was in college. And my problem is very quickly, the people that I would do impressions of, nobody knew who they were. So I could do these great, you know, Humphrey Bogart impressions or Richard Nixon or something. And people are, you know, by 1990, everybody's like, what are you doing? Who is that? What are you doing? I became obsolete. I became obsolete on that score.
Well, we've got already under our belt today a couple of war stories, but I don't want to cut you off, Bill. Seems like we've kind of come to the end of the topic of your presentation, which it is nice to sit back and get a lecture from a history PhD on something as important as this. And we will, by the way, you were courteous enough to send us your slides, which are not too detailed. And if, with your permission, we'll put a link to those.
Sure, that's great.
In our show notes so that other people can access them. And in true lawyer fashion, we have a disclaimer on slide number one about fair use of the materials in the public domain.
There you go. I know we got just a few minutes left, so I do have one more iteration of this subject that I think might be interesting. And that is that it has to do with legal education. And civic education in this country is really a depressing subject. And not just civic education, but education of young people in analytical thinking. You know, we were talking about, I mean, I don't know about you guys. Did you guys debate in high school?
Mm-hmm. Standard.
I learned everything I really needed to know about arguing in high school debate. Most of the great lawyers that I know, trial lawyers and appellate lawyers, either debated in high school or in college. I got a great story about the late mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, that I was told he was a classmate of mine in law school, a great guy. He was on the debate squad at U of H, but I won't tell that story. What I will say is that we have a real problem with young people not being capable of what we assume as a baseline in terms of analytical thinking. Right now, according to the educational resources that I looked at, right now, we have the highest percentage of fourth graders not reading at basic fourth grade level in the last 20 years. And we have the highest percentage of eighth graders not reading at eighth grade level in the last 30 years. And the same is true of their ability to do mathematics at grade level. And the reason this is problematic is because reading is more than just deciphering the figures on a page. People who can't read at eighth grade level are not capable of identifying the main point of like a one or two page essay. And they're not capable of identifying the two sides in an essay that attempts to lay out the arguments on either sides of an issue. And yet, you know, we expect these people to make tough judgments about economic policy, foreign policy, the issues that divide us so often. And so education is a big deal. ABOTA and a lot of other organizations, lawyer organizations, do a great job with programs like A Day in Court. We have Teachers Law School that ABOTA does, where we bring teachers in to the courtroom and spend a day with them, teaching them about the Constitution, teaching them about free speech in the classroom, and so on. We need to do as much of this as possible because we are failing our young people in terms of educating them in the simple ways of analytical thought that are needed for people to participate in a democracy. Another statistic I saw was something like 30% of, I think the number is 30% of adults in the United States read at a level you would expect from a 10-year-old, just basically fourth grade.
Well, that you raised that in the context of electoral politics, but you were just talking about jury service. It impacts that every bit as much, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. That's where you get the ladies who go, Well, I don't know this evidence stuff, but I feel sorry for that guy. His boots are scuffed up. We have a lot of things. We have a lot of frontiers that remain to be conquered if we want to maintain this republic and keep it going. Again, there's good news, like I say, that there's good and bad, right? I was talking about the ballast of the republic. There is this massive group of people in the middle, probably 40, 50% of us, who have eclectic views on the issues. Sometimes we're this, sometimes we're that, and who think of themselves as independent voters. That's a good thing. The bad thing is that because of the political gerrymandering that we talked about, the bad thing is that of the people who are falling out of the political system, who do not vote, who are no longer engaged, a disproportionate number of those people are in the middle. Because of the systemic issues that we've been talking about for the last hour, the extremists in both parties are running the sort of normal people out of politics because they're so disgusted by the negative advertising and the scandal mongering and, the revenge pendulum, if you want to call it that.
Well, Bill, this has been fascinating. Thank you for coming back on the show. I mean, we're happy you accepted the invitation, even though you kind of knew what you were getting yourself into.
That's fine. You know what they say? They say, don't get between Bill and a microphone. You might get hurt.
Well, it's an extremely important topic. And I think you're saying out loud, expressing concerns that a lot of us maybe haven't been able to articulate nearly as eloquently as you have, referring back to the Federalist Paper in Washington's farewell address. It puts it in an interesting historical context that we need to remember history. So it's super interesting topic and talk, and very appropriate for Law Day and for our 150th episode too, because we certainly want to encourage lawyers to do what they think is right to help preserve the rule of law in our republic every way. So thanks again for coming on the show, being with us. And
well, you guys are doing a great job, great service to the appellate bar and to the bar in general. And I would just say one of my favorite sayings, which is history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Well, that's a very good note to end on, I think, Bill. So thanks again for coming.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.